to RSP or not RSP? That is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and, by opposing, end them. I'm going to stop there, because this will go on far too long.
Alas, poor listener, 'tis the Religious Studies Project again. I'm here with my associate and friend, Chris Cotter. Say hi.
Hello, I'm here with David Robertson.
And we are the Religious Studies Project. We and our venerable army of associate editors and
contributors and interviewers
and listeners and everybody, in fact, all the way down to you listening today. You're part of the Religious Studies Project, whether you like it or not.
That's a good way to think of what we're doing, because what the name just kind of came to us in a pub in Durham, but now that I think about it, we could see the name Religious Studies Project as being a sort of global project to embody the good, the best things in religious studies. I can maybe see us as a, we are a global project.
Well, we are now. Well, yes, if you don't count Africa and Asia.
Well, we get a lot of listeners, I'm sure.
We do. We're trying.
We're trying.
But if you are listening, aware that we are sorely underrepresented in those areas, though.
I see. What we're doing is part of a project.
It's a project which is global in its scope. We're not yet a global project, but we're certainly a non-local project.
Yeah.
We're like the, you know, the Heidelberg principle in that sense. We're non-local.
Okay. Don't quite get what you mean by the Heidelberg principle, but we'll just.
I turn a quark over here, a quark somewhere in Alabama. Turns. Anyway,
I think I need some more education to understand what you're talking about there, David.
Well, on the topic of education, education and religion has been a hot potato recently, hasn't it?
And not really for us yet, which is surprising given that we've been going to you.
For the project?
Yeah.
Because we are, you know, working on a book addressing kind of how religion could be educated. But enough about that. It'd be nice to have somebody who came on and just kind of discussed how the different approaches to teaching about religion, not teaching religion, but teaching about religion, could be addressed and sort of, you know, put that in a nutshell for us.
In a podcast form, yeah. And accepting that there's sometimes a disjuncture between what goes on in the academic study of religion at a university level and what many people experience learning about religion in school contexts.
Very much so. Would that be, for instance, in Scotland, religious and moral education, which includes...
Well, no, it's religious, moral and philosophical education now, I believe. RMPS.
Well, that's changed recently then. Yeah, but point stands, yeah.
Yeah, in schools here, certainly it's always seen as, if you're learning about religion, it's a wasted class, it's a dusty class that you go to, and you learn about things like abortion and how churches are, you know, organized into a cruciform shape, and you comment on whether euthanasia is okay or not, and that's the level of depth that people tend to get at school, and why are they not getting what we do as sort of.
I feel a rant coming on, so I'm going to suggest that we go to Tim Jensen and
Jonathan Tuckett.
And Jonathan Tuckett right now, recorded at last year's EASR/BASR conference. Here we go.
Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. It's been a while since you've heard my voice, but I'm Jonathan Tuckett, one of the rarer interview viewers for the project. We're here at the EASR/BASR conference in Liverpool, and it is my great pleasure to speak with Tim Jensen from the University of Southern Denmark on the topic of religion education. So, Tim, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you very much.
Great. So, You were in a panel yesterday, so I was just wondering if you could begin by talking about what the general purpose of the panel was, because you were talking about the topic of religion education.
Well, several years ago, a colleague of mine, Wanda Albert, who's now professor at the University of Leibniz in Hanover, she and I put together a working group within the European Association for the Study of Religions on religion education in public schools, a specific eye to Europe, and with a specific eye to religion education based on the scientific or the study of religion, scientific study of religion, academic study of religion, whatever you want. But we want to sort of start a working group that is not beginning with pedagogics, neither beginning sort of with what we have out there or what we do not have, but what would it look like to have a religion education program in public schools if you started from the approach to religion that you find within the academic study of religion. That's our idea, because we are dissatisfied with several of the ways that states and educational systems administer religious education. We don't think they are sort of scientific enough.
Okay, so that's great. So what is it about the current system that isn't scientific enough?
Well, first of all, quite a few places you have a good religion education in place, like, for instance, in Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and also partly in the UK, for instance, other places. But even there, you will find a lot of examples that this school subject is not treated just like any other school subject. As one of the presenters from Norway said yesterday, it's always as if you expect, even in teacher education or teacher training, something extra to be necessary for a teacher of religion education. He or she is supposed to have a specific sort of attitude to religion. He or she is supposed to be more than a teacher, sort of, let's say, sharing knowledge, teaching about. He or she is also supposed to be sort of a model educator or almost a guru in regard to sort of values, democracy, intercultural understanding, whatever, tolerance and all that stuff. And also he or she is supposed to be able to speak about existential life questions with the pupils and all that. You would never sort of require that from a math teacher or from a teacher in biology, right? But you do. And for that reason, religion education so far has a hard time becoming a normal school subject, where you have an academic basis, so to speak, the academic tradition now, study of religions, and then, of course, you recontextualize it. You make sort of didactic choices, etc., because you move from one context, university, to another, the school, be it elementary, upper secondary, whatever. So, of course, you have to regard didactics and pedagogics, but you have to have the scientific basic in order. And at quite a few places, you don't have that. It will be theology, philosophy of life, things like that, and not sort of a normal study of religions-based religion education.
So there's a difference in the sense that when we come to universities and we learn about religions, we learn it in a specific way according to specific programs, which is very different to the kind of programs that school children...
No, my idea is that it's not going to be that different, right. But it's going to be recontextualized because you deal with another age group,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
You just cannot tell 6 years old the same things that you can tell 26 years old. Mm. Or if you do, you have to do it in another way.
Yeah.
That's the point, right?
Yeah.
But the point is that you actually do tell them the same things, but you just sort of accommodate the situation, so to speak. But we are thinking that it is important to insist that the basis for religion education in public school ought be the academic study of religions. Why? Because our idea, of course, is that you're going to have what Wanda Albers called an integrative religion education, meaning that you teach all pupils, be they black or white, male or female, Muslims or whatever, in the same classroom. To teach them the same material, there is no difference. They are actually not there in the classroom as Muslims, as Hindus, as girls and boys, so to speak. They are there as pupils. And the idea is that you teach them about religion in an impartial way, in a way based on the scientific study of religion. And we find it extremely important that the the approach to religion is trans-confessional, so to speak. It is non-confessional, but it's trans-confessional. They are to be taught about religion. And I think I share with Wendy Alberts, but I would just talk for myself now, the idea that societies, in order to function in the world today, and states sort of have to be secular, not secularistic, not anti-religious, but you have to establish a framework where religious and non-religious voices, etc., and a plurality of religious voices and non-religious voices can sort of be. They have to be there. It's a democratic, open society. But in order to have that, you also have to have a non-religious discourse on religion. Yeah, that's necessary. And you have to have citizens who are capable of critically analyzing discourses, be it politicians or religious discourses or anti-religious atheist discourses on religion, from the point of view of studying religions. So you can establish, and I think any state must sort of have, ought to have an interest if it has an open democratic society to establish an academic study of religion at the university level. But I think that it should then also have study of religions-based religion education in public schools, because it is of interest to the state to produce citizens who are well-educated also when it comes to religion. And you know, quite a few of my colleagues around Europe, they will say that religion education should be closely linked to citizenship education, that it should be promoting human rights, that it should be promoting intercultural understanding. That's all fine with me if that could be sort of a side effect or benefit. But I don't want to put it up there in front. I think that it's wiser, smarter to say, we consider scientific knowledge about religion of value. So that's one thing. So if we want to talk into the language of societies and politicians on values, I would say, okay, Enlightenment tradition, there must be something you could say in this regard. Knowledge, scientifically based knowledge, is of value, also when it comes to religion. That's one thing.
Just
1 minute. So if you say scientifically based knowledge is of value, then it must also be of value to have knowledge about religion. This is my first step. It is that simple, because religion is part and parcel of world history. Mm. So if you want to know about history, you have to know about religion. If you want to know social formation, you have to know about religion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there is no escape. You have to know something about religion.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to raise as a question that came up during the panel itself, was why should states themselves be interested in it? In the sense that, to certain respects, primary and secondary education at school level is about developing good citizens. Mm. So should we be involved in that sort of discussion? I mean, in certain respects, the university level.
Well, let me get back to that with the university level. But I think that a state, of course, has an interest normally in reproducing sort of nationalist identities. So nationalism is still big, even if we have a global world. And actually, you have seen neo-nationalism bloom over the last 20 years. So we've had politics of identities in Europe. So yes, we are European, but still we are Germans or British or we are Danish. And everybody has been busy trying to define what is Danishness, what is Britishness, etc. And religion always pops up. Well, we are Protestants and they are Catholics and they are Muslims and we are. And therefore, you have seen a lot of states using religion education to promote building up, constructing of national identities with regard to religion. But I think that some of these states also could be addressed in a way and say, Mr. State, please listen to me. That's one thing, the cultural religious heritage. But you also have to have a responsibility in regard to the Enlightenment heritage, whether it's Europe or the individual country. And you also have an interest in producing citizens who know more than one religion, who know about other religions in the past out there, for various reasons. Simply because if not, they do not know about history. So if you say it's important to know about history, you should also say it's important to know about history of religions.
Yes.
It's very brief, but you're right. Are states interested in producing critical citizens?
Mm.
I think they ought to be. And I think it's sort of a prerequisite for what we call an open democratic society. So I'm just a believer. I hope that states could be persuaded to see an interest in producing not just sheep, but also critical citizens.
I'm going to change the question slightly, because at the time it was like this idea that it's religious studies in secondary education that has the responsibility of developing a good citizen, whereas you don't have that aspect in the other subjects. But would we be having the problem we're having now if those other subjects were geared towards developing good citizens, if maths was taught in such a way as to be about making you a better citizen? So if all the subjects across secondary education...
Quite a few of them are supposed to, because if you look at the sort of the curricula for most state schools, they will have sort of general aims, right? And in principle, all the school subjects are supposed to, for instance, in Denmark, give the pupils an intimate knowledge about Danish culture and some knowledge about other cultures. And that is, even if it is, what could you say, sports, in a way, it's supposed to do the same. It's ridiculous, but all are supposed to. But it's just as if they always pick out religion education as the place where it's most adequate, so to speak. Now, I would like to come back to another of your questions. You said, what has the study of religion, the academic study of religion, to do with this? Well, I think that, first of all, it has something to do with this because it wants to sort of, let's call it, it wants to make use of itself or make itself useful also beyond the academy. I think that it's an obligation for scholars within the academy to not only communicate with each other in learned journals and societies, but also to communicate with the society at large. This is part of the religious studies projects also, I guess, right? And it's, so there has to be a sharing of knowledge, not only with colleagues, but with the public at large. That sharing of knowledge can take place in many ways. You can publish books that are meant for the public at large. That's good, that's good. You can also write articles to newspapers. You can appear as an expert to the media, as I have done for several years in Denmark. So you can do it in various ways. I think that a very sort of obvious and evident way to do it is to share your knowledge by way of education, meaning that, do as we have done in Denmark since 1912. Take in at the university, if at all possible, the responsibility for teaching or training and educating the teachers for the public schools related in education. It has also been a great business for us because we have a lot of students who have to go and have the study of religion in order to be religion education teachers. And then you can produce textbooks, as we also do in Denmark. So you can do a lot of things, and it's quite safe. Because I myself have experienced how dangerous it is to be an expert to the media, because it's quite another ball game. And you are speaking into a discourse that you cannot control because it's a media discourse. And I really put the sort of the respectability of myself as a scholar and also the respectability and credibility of the study of religions at risk each and every time I appear as an expert, because I can always end up be accused of being politicizing or something like that instead of just delivering objective knowledge. And that is a risk. But while if you do it via religion education, it's not that risky.
I want to tie this notion of the idea that you do take a risk when you enter into the public discourse as an expert or anything like that. And the idea of the university level of education now, because this was a point that came up during the panels as well yesterday, was that out of 100 students, you will only have one or two who will go on to be researchers at the PhD level and themselves become lecturers. So do we need to start thinking about the university curricula in terms of making our skills less research, teaching people how to be researchers, and more about teaching them how to be experts who can engage in public environments and reduce their risks as they do
so? It's a difficult question. But I think that, for instance, in Denmark, at my university, we have already done that for many years. First of all, we have the tradition of educating religion education teachers. But the study program we have for those actually is exactly the same as we have for any other student, no matter what kind of career. But we are thinking in terms of ways of career, or career, what could you call it? Different careers.
Yeah.
And there will be one, religion education, but then there will be another one, research. But in between, so to speak, we also try to find a way for those who think that they should be advisors, that should be consultants, that they should, you know, function in regard to intercultural challenges, etc., etc., or they should be publishers, something like that, where they use their knowledge about religion in an applied way, so to mm-hmm. speak, in order to, if not solve problems, then facilitate things, right? And so I have, for instance, for many, many years, taught a course on religion and communication, where it's not just a question of teaching the students about how to become an RE teacher, how to write a textbook, how to prepare a lecture for children, etc., etc. But it also sort of a training where you say, okay, if you're going to write about religion for a ladies' magazine, how do you do that? If you're going to appear as an expert on TV, how then do you explain about Shia Islam in 2 minutes instead of in 2 hours, right? How do you do that? So how do you reproduce your knowledge as a scholar in regard to the public at large? So we train that. And I think that we are soon going to have one career also where we are going to focus much more attention upon the applied science of religion in regard to, let's say, hospitals, prisons, police officers, etc. What do you need to know about religion if you are to function as a diplomat or as a soldier or, as I said, a policeman in a multi-religious society? That's another way of doing it.
Is Denmark unique in that case, or is it southern Denmark alone that is unique in that case?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, we have this tradition of religion education, but we also now realize that not only do citizens and children have knowledge about religion that comes from not only the churches or the mosques and their parents and the schools, it also comes from television and popular culture. So we also have to sort of analyze and teach about popular culture and religion in popular culture. But likewise, we also have to teach them to analyze that critically and also to themselves produce those things. I mean, how do you produce that kind of, well, information about religion, right?
I'm thinking more about the fact that you teach your students to condense 2 hours into 2 minutes. I'm thinking Scottish context, the Scottish universities that I've attended, that we don't teach that sort of thing.
I find it important because it is part of this tradition with religion education, because you have to sort of be tough on yourself. If you give a university course on Islam, you may have a semester of 13 weeks, or maybe you have two. If you're in upper secondary school, you may have 20 lectures, right? And instead of having 700 pages book, you have 70 pages. So what are you going to pick for those 70 pages? What is important? What do you put together? How do you represent Islam if you have 70 pages and 70 minutes instead of 700, right? And I find this an attractive exercise, and I think some students also do. Apart from that, it is interesting to study religion education for a scholar of religion. So it's not just applied science of religion where we can sort of make ourselves useful in schools. It's also a study object. Yeah. That's another side of it, right? Because I'm interested in religion, but actually I'm not that interested in religion out there. I'm bored. I mean, a lot of religion, really, I find it extremely boring. Mm. I find it interesting to figure out why the hell is it is there, and that's why I like cognitive science of religion or evolutionist, etc., biology. Why is it there? It's really strange. So why hasn't it died out, etc.? But to go there and see what Sikhs are doing, I have done that. I know what they are doing, and Jews and Muslims. There are still riddles. It can still be interesting, but I get bored. I don't want to sit and drink soda pops with Muslims in hours in mosques on Fridays or go to church. No. But I'm fascinated about the way people discuss religion, how they see religion, what they think about what we call religion. And that includes states. How do states handle religion? How do they see it in regard to their citizens, in regard to the position in schools? I find that fascinating. So that's why I'm also in this business of studying religion education, because it's part of the picture of where is religion going, right?
Okay, I'm going to pick up on this idea of states, because I want to go back to what you were saying about the idea that we want to develop critical citizens, and yeah. how the earlier comment about how the citizens are effectively, they're trying to indoctrinate their own citizens. Is the idea, the notion of a critical citizen, part of the indoctrination of democratic societies? Are we promoting the idea of critical citizens just because we're in a democracy? And if we go outside our European...
That is also why you will find politicians trying to use religion education not only to promote citizenship education, primarily aimed at Muslims. It's always... I mean, the whole discourse on citizenship education in Europe, in Denmark, has to do with the fact that you have got some minorities, larger minorities of Muslims, and you have an idea that Muslims and democracy does not work together. So it's aimed at those. Of course, also at the old ethnic Danes, so to speak, who just don't behave, right? Who are criminals or stupid, etc. Yeah. So you have to educate in democracy. But it would never be so strong if not for the conceived fear of Islamist Muslims, so to speak, right? Who do not like democracy. So a lot of politicians in Denmark, for instance, would say, from day one, you have to make religion education compulsory because we, goddammit, got to brainwash these Muslims, right? We're going to make them democratic. And part of that is to give them analytical, critical, self-critical competences.
Yeah.
And it's true. But it's no more true for Muslims than it could be for children of Jehovah's Witnesses and Christian parents. And that, for that reason, in Denmark, you still have the tradition that the first 5 years, the pupils are supposed not really to learn about other religions. Because first you give them the parents' and the nation's religions, and then when they are sort of safe in their own religion, then they can be sort of exposed to the shock that there are more than one God, right? or more than one truth. But I think that's a myth. I think that it's the parents who cannot sort of cope with the fact that the world is multicultural, multi-religious. Children can. But still, you're right. If it works, the study of religion in some ways changes those who do it or are exposed to it. Because it does pave the way for some kind of critical, analytical mass, but also for some kind of relativism. It is. And I mean, this has been the big sort of, I think, very important part of the study of religions and its impact. It has paved the way for some kind of cultural religious relativism that I find praiseworthy. And I simply do find it worthwhile to tell people, are you so damn sure that what you think is true is absolutely the only truth? And if you study world religions, past and present, you sort of discover that it's not that simple.
It's interesting that you just mentioned world religions, because that's another topic that's kind of come up, the whole world religions paradigm and how it's a little bit defunct these days. Do you think if the world religion paradigm is also inhibiting the critical abilities of students?
Now, I just said the world's religions, not the world religions. Meaning all the religions of the world.
Right.
Indigenous religions, whatever, minority religions. That was my point.
Okay.
You're quite right. But that's one thing. But I think that it can lead to some kind of relativist way of thinking that I find very helpful. So I'm not an anti-relativist in that regard. And when it comes to the world religions paradigm, sort of, that you could also link to the UK tradition with Ninian Smart, etc., etc. Yeah, quite a few of my colleagues, for instance, Wanda Alberts, they think that we should get rid of that, and that's why they also include non-religious worldviews, etc., etc. I see the point of Masu Sava, I see the point of the whole thing. I know from the study of religions how difficult it is to call something. Well, I don't buy into it from a moral point of view that we have to take care of the minorities. I think it's difficult. It is difficult, but of course the ideal situation is to also have time to deal with minority religions or with indigenous traditions. But actually in Denmark we did that until recently. It was compulsory in religion education to have quite a lot teaching about indigenous traditions, because they were, like in the study of religions, conceived sort of the beginning of the study of religions. Not that it was sort of an evolutionist scheme, but still we had developed our analytical terms, our phenomenological terms, within the study of indigenous religions. And besides, you know, the pupils were very happy about it because they came from primary school where they had only had about Christianity and world religion, so it was nice to have something about American Indians or Inuits or whatever it could be. So, no, I think that it is, of course, necessary to teach about from a sociology of religion point of view, majority and minority religions. Mm. And I think most, at least in upper secondary school, most teachers will also sort of have to do it simply by way of teaching about not only Islam as a world religion, but also Islam as a minority religion in Denmark or in Sweden or in Europe or wherever it is, but also touch upon other minority religions. So it is not just world religions. But it's a tough one, but again, why not? I mean, there is a certain size. Mm. I mean, it's the same. I'm always trying to defend that Christianity has a little bit more time on the schedule than the other religions. Why? Because it's so big.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the biggest religion. And in Denmark, furthermore, I think that in order to emancipate yourself from Christian theological notions about religion, you really have to know about that religion in order to get rid of it. And this is also one of the reasons I think more hours set apart for the study of the Christian religion, because if not, we cannot make the pupils or the students realize to what a degree they are influenced in their thinking about religion, especially from a Christian point of view.
Now, you mentioned phenomenology, and right, certain listeners will probably get all head up because it's me talking about phenomenology again. But I was just wondering, based on, you have this idea of how the universities should be in a certain respects and how religious studies should be gone about, does that present a threat to certain methodologies? I mean, from a phenomenological perspective, I feel a slight nervousness about the whole, I'm a public benefit skeptic, and how religious studies scholars should be getting involved in public discourses. And particularly people who will talk about notions of pure science and that science doesn't really involve itself in that kind of thing. So will this vision ostracize certain methodologies, do you think? Or can they still be incorporated into the study?
Of course.
Right.
I mean, if you have our study program at the University of Southern Denmark, we will have an obligation to teach, you know, very thoroughly the history of religions or the history of the study of religions, theory and method, and we'll have to cover them all. We have a course in phenomenology of religion. We still call it that. Mm. We don't care. I mean, we all know that it may be a problematic word or term.
Yeah.
Call it comparative religion, but we know what it's all there for. And as I said at another seminar yesterday, I still consider a real scholar of religion one who can combine a historical, philological approach with a sort of cross-cultural, whatever you call it, comparative phenomenology of religion approach. But we are far away from Eliade or Van der Lerbe, etc., and even Ninian Smart. I mean, Bruce Lincoln is doing the study of myth in quite another way. We are studying, you know, the way that authority is established and power, etc. So we are not just, it's not the old-fashioned way. So it's all there. We also have to have, you know, time to teach about cognitivist approaches. So I don't see that there is any problem there. I see that some scholars could be nervous about applied science or whatever, especially also religion. But this is also why I say that applying it to religion education, one way or the other, is a safe way to go.
Right.
You don't compromise sort of the scientific one, especially if you follow the lead of Wanda Alberts and I, because this is our whole project. We want to link religion education in public schools very, very closely to the academic scientific study of religions.
Okay, I think that's a great point on which to finish this discussion. I've been Jonathan Tuckett, and this is Tim Jensen from the University of Southern Denmark. Thank you very much.
I'm the one to thank you.
Well, you've gathered from the impending rant at the start of that podcast that there's a lot that we could say about it, but I think maybe it's best that we leave it to Denise Kusch. He's a professor at Bath Spa University. He has written a detailed and quite excellent response to Tim Jensen.
I'm delighted to have that, actually. Yeah,
it's brilliant. Denise is someone that we also could have had on to do that interview. We thought, well, it'd be great to have both Denise and Tim involved. So we've got Denise has written a response to this, and she can sort of unpack some of the questions that I have related to this.
At my institution recently, Chris, we had external examiners in to check the courses, and they noted, well, it's very interesting that undergraduate, the women much outweigh the men, and this postgraduate, that the men appear to much outweigh the women.
And I wondered how much that had to do with the way that religious studies was taught at school level. Yeah. Whether one, it was as you sort of suggested earlier on, that it seems a soft touch, you know, a touchy feely thing about morals, and maybe that for young men this is not something that they want to be going into, but also maybe it misrepresents actually the meat of the field, which I see as being a particularly analytical field and very self-referential.
So interesting. Whenever I say to someone I'm doing religious studies, and their mind goes to school, and they think, well, they either don't want to talk to me, or they're just like, how dull. How dull is that? Why are you interested in this? It's fascinating. And there is something, I think, going wrong in schools, that people aren't interested. It doesn't mean that you have to be religious or anti-religious. It's just that, you know, there's a whole corpus of material out there which doesn't really get touched upon, which I find fascinating, and our whole approach.
It comes down to this. You don't see the world the same way that everybody else does. Are you not fascinated by that?
If you're not, well, fair enough.
If you're
enough.
Not, then you're not bad. I'm surprised. How can you not? Yeah. You must have in your life at least one time met somebody who had fundamentally a different epistemological position than you and thought, oh, I get on really well with this guy, but they think they believe completely different things from me. Is that not fascinating?
Well, clearly if you've listened this far into the podcast, you probably think it is fascinating, but
I think most people listening to this are believing that they're going to go and do something else at any point.
So on that note, it's just time to tell you about what's happening over the next few weeks. Definitely got three podcasts in a series for you. There's a possibility that we're going to have a fourth. We've got a series on, we're calling it our Origins series.
It should be Origins in quotation marks.
Yes. Yeah. Everything that we basically say in this entire podcast should be probably in quotation marks, but you can't see us doing the scare quotes. But next week's a really, really good interview. It's with Stuart Guthrie.
Yeah, please do this one.
We're just absolutely delighted to have this. It's another one from Tommy Coleman, who's just been churning out the interviews recently. We're really grateful for that. We hope that you will too.
Yeah, Stuart Guthrie is like, it's like when we had Martin Stringer's one on. I mean, these are books that aren't necessarily, they're quite recent books, but they're having a big impact, I think, actually. The work in them is, I've heard lots of people mention them sort of casually in passing. They're not those kind of books that everybody quotes, like a Bourdieu or a Foucault or something, but they are the books that people in the field are getting intrigued by and are starting to become important works in the field, I think. So, you know, we had Martin Stringer, and if you haven't heard our interview with him, you can go back and listen to that. But now to have Stuart Guthrie as well is great.
Really good. So thanks for that, Tommy, and thanks, Stuart. Just to close out, we're presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, who are fantastic. Our Facebook page, probably by this point, will have breached the 1,500 mark. When we recorded this, it was about 1484, so I think we should have done by then. But keep following us there.
If you haven't, do it now.
We're on Google Plus.
David has asked me if you could say thanks for listening in Danish.
Thank you for listening. Tak fordi du lyttede med.
Thank you very much.